This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Almost everybody who owns a cell phone, and that's almost everybody, has wondered at some point or another whether using those things might lead to brain cancer. Decades worth of research can't seem to come up with a definitive answer, and each inconclusive or contradictory result leads to more questions along the intersection of science, law, and the media. If you have questions about what you've heard concerning cell phones and brain cancer, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, what would you say if one of your neighbors asked if he could sleep over? But first, cell phones and brain cancer, and we turn to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, a practicing physician, who wrote a piece in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He is also the author of The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer, which just yesterday received the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure.
In the New York Times piece, you start by telling us how all this came to public attention back in the early 90s, back before a lot of us had cell phones.
Absolutely. I mean, the first cases, started appearing in the public media, and probably the very first case was a case filed by David Raynard in Florida. And Raynard's wife, Susie Ellen Raynard, had developed brain cancer and astrocytoma. And the Raynards brought suit against NEC and GTE, the cell phone manufacturer and cell phone carrier, claiming that the use of the cell phone had caused the astrocytoma.
And everybody, I think, remembers, if not that case specifically, the claim that the brain tumor was in the exact shape of the antenna of the cell phone.
That's right. So this is what David Raynard claimed. As I said, as I point out in the piece, it's very hard to shapes of tumors are very hard. I haven't seen her particular MRI or CAT scan, but often patients will come to me and say, look, doesn't this tumor resemble either the shape of a cell phone, or doesn't a tumor resemble the shape of something that I held close to my head? Usually it's a very hard thing to interpret because, like clouds, the tumors take the shape of our imaginations. So this is what David Raynard certainly thought, that there was a relationship between the cell phone and her tumor.
And you go through then a lot of the science involved in trying to determine whether there should be, whether scientists can discover a link between brain cancer and cell phones. And the first one would be simply everybody started using cell phones all of a sudden at the same time. There ought to be, if there's a link, there ought to be a sudden spike in the number of brain cancers.
Right. I mean, the point that I'm trying to make in this, that I try to make in this piece, and in fact, it's a point that I also make in The Emperor of All Maladies, my book, is that finding a causal agent for cancer is not like solving a mathematical equation. It is not like there is a single magical formula that will allow us to find and define a cancer-causing agent or a carcinogen. In fact, the way it's defined, or such a way such carcinogens are ever described or identified, is through a process that really resembles a detective case, solving a detective case, in which you take one piece of evidence, you add another piece of evidence, and often you're looking for corroborative pieces of evidence. And so the first piece of evidence that you might want to look for is, well, is there a coincidence in usage? So in other words, as the usage of cell phones has accelerated, almost creating a natural experiment between the late 80s and 2011, has there been an increase in brain tumors? Because if the cell phones truly contain a carcinogen, then increasing cell phone use dramatically, as has happened, should increase the rate of the development of brain cancers in America.
And yet, when you go through the data, it doesn't show up.
Absolutely. So the data, there have been several studies, but two major ones. One of them, an earlier study, showed that the rate has essentially remained flat from about. Now, the first thing you've to remember is that these brain cancers are extremely rare. There are about 6 to 7 cases diagnosed per 100,000 men and women in America. So the rates are very rare. So it's very important to start this conversation by saying that we're looking at a phenomenon that already is an extremely rare phenomenon. You're vastly more likely, I suspect, to die of an accident because of the misuse of a cell phone while driving by several fold. The danger of brain cancer is vastly less than that. But that said, let's just concentrate for a second on brain cancer. The rate remained flat between 1992 and about the mid-2000s. A subsequent study has updated that, and overall the rate remains flat as well, except there is a small increase from 2.5 cases per 100,000 to 2.6 cases per 100,000 of tumors in the frontal lobe only in women and not in men. Now, that part of the brain is not a part of the brain that we typically think is associated with holding a cell phone. It's not near the ear. It's not near either of the ears, but actually is in the front of the lobe. And again, it's a change from 2.5 to 2.6 per 100,000 men and women. I don't know what the cause of this is, but most scientists think that it's unlikely that phone use is what's causing it. It might even just be, it probably is just random fluctuations. With such small numbers and such large denominators, it's very likely that you have small fluctuations like 2.5 to 2.6, as you can imagine.
Sure. And there are other methods to determine whether something is a carcinogen or not. But one of the main ideas behind the thing radiates, it sends out radiation. Isn't that carcinogenic? And you point out, well, not the kind of radiation necessarily that a cell phone uses.
That's right. So, in fact, it's very important in order to have sophisticated and important conversations about cancer and carcinogens, we need to define some terms. The kind of radiation, the word radiation really means any radiant energy that's coming out of any source. So, for instance, while I'm sitting here in the studio in New York, I'm being bombarded with radiation from an electrical light. From an ordinary light. There's also radiation that's coming through the window. For the most part, these forms of radiation don't affect the way they don't affect the DNA of the cell. They can't mutate genes and therefore are very unlikely to cause cancer because they don't really have any capacity to alter genes directly. Cell phone radiation happens to belong to that part of the spectrum. It's the very low energy part of the spectrum in contrast to radiation from X-rays. So even though we use the word radiation, it really is a huge range, ranging from very energetic rays, such as X-rays, which can burrow through your tissues, break up DNA, cause mutations, and thereby increase cancer rates on one end of that spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum are things like, light, sunlight, and other forms of radiation, which are much less energetic. Of course, there's some forms of light that reach a kind of energy that's important, but for most radiant light, we don't have that kind of energy, and cellular phones lie in that spectrum.
We should point out, most of you listening to the radio, well, radio stations send out radiation too.
Absolutely. And therefore, the word radio.
Therefore, the word radio. And it's also down on the lower end of the spectrum, and I don't think there's ever been any questions about that. But anyway, we want to get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest is Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, an assistant professor of medicine in medical oncology and celebrating his new Pulitzer Prize for Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, which he received yesterday, the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. We're talking today, Bo, about the link, or trying to establish the link, or the search for the link between cell phones and brain cancer. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. We'll start with George, and George with us from Charleston.
Yes.
Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in the what his comment would be on the X-ray photograph that I saw that very, very exactly emulated the shape of a cell phone, and it was exactly in the location that a cell phone would be when one is using it. And the other question, or the other comment I'd like him to make is he aware of the radically reduced sensitivity that one would have to a cell phone if it were placed several feet away from the ear, as I saw many people using cell phones, especially Qualcomm cell phones, early on. And I realized the reason for that was that these were contractor types that they knew somehow that the emitted radiation was harmful to them, and the company itself, Qualcomm, knew this as well, and so they had a feature that allowed users to hold the phone at a distance and you know,
thereby reduce exposure. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, Dr.
Well, it's hard for me to comment on the exact shape of a tumor in the brain, which looks like a cell phone. I've never seen such a picture. I've certainly seen many pictures of. I've treated several patients with various forms of brain cancer, and I must say, in my perhaps somewhat limited experience, I have never seen a tumor that looks exactly like a cell phone. Perhaps others have. And the second question is, what about this phenomenon? You know, do these contractors know something that we don't? And is this the reason that they're holding their cell phones away? I mean, I don't have a problem with people holding their cell phones away. That's a matter of personal discretion. If these contractors do know something, I'd love to know it as well. It turns out what we do know is the material that we have from these the several trials, not one, but multiple different kinds of trials that I referred to in my piece. And I actually talk about this, some of these trials in my book as well. But that's the evidence that we have, and the evidence remains weak and inconclusive that moderate cell phone use in adults is a carcinogen. Now, you know, I said the word moderate, I said adults, because that's where we have the strongest pieces of evidence.
George, I suspect you're unconvinced.
Well, yeah, it sounds good, but, you know, seeing is believing, and I must tell you, I've had some rather interesting experiences after using cell phones. Yeah, I am, And one of the things is that after having used the cell phone significantly, let's say for a period of several days, several hours each day, I found that when I passed underneath a fairly normal power line, I was surprised at my sensitivity to it. I was actually able to feel the electromagnetic radiation as I had never felt before, and you know that was an astonishing phenomenon to me, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Once again, I mean, I don't have thoughts about that in particular. I would encourage you to really let the National Institute of Toxicology know about these kinds of sensitivities, because, again, if you're feeling something, then it's probably worthwhile studying it in a non-biased way, you know, turning the power lines on and off and see if this sensitivity really correlates with that. Thus far, as I said, the studies really haven't panned out.
We'll have more with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. If you have questions for him about what you've heard concerning brains, cancer, and cell phones, give us a call. 800-989-8255. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. It might sound simple to connect a suspected carcinogen to an incidence of cancer, like connecting tobacco smoking to lung cancer, but it wasn't in that case, and it's especially not true for the case of cell phones and brain cancer. Ruling cell phones in or out as carcinogens is important, according to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, who wrote a piece about this for the New York Times Magazine, because to label everything potentially carcinogenic is like crying wolf about cancer. If you have questions about what you've heard concerning cell phones and brain cancer, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Dr. Mukherjee is with us from our bureau in New York. And let's go next to Kaylin. Kaylin with us from Plainville in Connecticut.
Hi. I just like your guest, if he knows anything. When I was doing research on my phone a couple of years ago, I came across the RF values. And in that research, I saw an interesting image of a scan of an adult head and a scan of a child's head. And the RF frequency in the adult head went about a third into the soft tissue, and the RF frequency into a child went all the way into the middle of his head. So I was wondering if that could have any relation to cancers or tumors in the brain.
Well, again, the notion of modeling the way radiation penetrates into the head when you use a cell phone has been around for a long time. And it's quite clear to me that, in fact, the old models, much like, in general, old models are not great. And we are refining these models all the time from the scientific perspective, really figuring out what is the depth. And as you've pointing out correctly, a child's skull is very different from an adult skull. Now, again, what this kind of modeling research shows us is that there's different exposures available or that happen, that occur in a child's skull versus an adult skull. But the meat of the question that you're asking is the difference in that exposure consequential or not? Does it really mean something? It's one thing to say there's a different level of exposure, but there's another. It's quite something else to say that different level of exposure causes cancer. So just to give you an example, you can change the settings on your light switch to go from dim to extremely bright, but neither of those, although the levels of exposure that you get are vastly different, neither of those, as far as we know, is carcinogenic. So again, it really boils down to the question, what is the meat of the evidence that regardless of how one models exposure to a child's skull versus an adult skull, is there any solid evidence connecting this form of radiation with cancer? And as I point out in my article, which I would encourage you to read, the evidence ranges not only from human studies, but also to animal studies, and then finally to cellular studies. And thus far, there appears to be very weak and unconvincing evidence. Now, that said, there are two major trials that are still out there, two so-called definitive trials, one from Europe and one from America. And, I hope that will settle the issue once and for all. But thus far, I would say that the evidence remains pretty negative.
Caitlin, thanks very much.
Okay, thanks.
You write in your piece that the rarity of the cancer provokes a desperate and often corrosive search for a cause. Why, of all people, did I get an astrocytoma? When patients with brain tumors happen to share a common exposure, in this case cell phones, the line between cause and coincidence begins to blur. The association does not stand out, nor does it disappear into statistical white noise. Instead, it remains suspended like some sort of peculiar optical illusion that is blurry to some and all too clear to others.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I started off thinking about while I was writing this piece, and again, I had been thinking about this in writing the Emperor of All Maladies, I began to wonder about how the juxtaposition of cause and cancer are put together. So as it turns out, if you have a very rare cause and a very rare cancer, then often these two things stand out. Like the analogy I give is it's a little bit like a lunar eclipse. Mm-hmm. A classical analogy of that is it turns out that in the 19th century, in the 18th and 19th century, chimney sweepers in England suddenly started developing scrotal cancer, cancer of the scrotum. Now, chimney sweeping was a relatively rare profession, particularly among young adolescents. And the scrotal cancer was an extremely rare form of cancer. And so epidemiologists, most notably Sir Percival Pott, immediately figured out that the rare and the rare, if you put them together, there must be a relationship. So that's what happens when you have a rare and rare. The trouble is that when you have a rare cancer and a very common exposure, and that's what's happening to some extent with brain cancer and cell phones. Brain cancers, as I said, are about 6 to 7 cases per 100,000 men and women in America. Cell phone usage is now ranging from 70% to 90%, depending on where you are. So when one has a very common exposure and a very rare cancer, it's very hard to figure out whether it's cause or coincidence. It's like saying, is there a relationship between sitting and cancer? Or is there a relationship between drinking milk and brain cancer? Well, many people with brain cancer will have had a prior exposure to milk or to sitting. That is not to say that this is clearly a very important way to tease out cause and correlation, but it becomes statistically very difficult to do, and that's what I point out in my piece.
Well, let's go next to George. George with us from Chardon in Iowa.
Yeah, I saw an article in my alumni magazine from the University of California at Berkeley where the University of California School of Public Health had gone back and looked at all the various studies on this issue, and they found that when they sorted out the studies that had been funded by the telephone companies, that the preponderance of the studies showed that there was a connection. And when they looked at those telephone studies that were funded by the telephone companies, there were obvious flaws in the methodology.
Well, I tried again in my piece to identify the sources of funding for various studies, and it's, as you can imagine, that's an extremely difficult thing to do because many people don't declare their funding. On a side note, I'd just like to tell you very clearly, I have no funding whatsoever. My funding sources are quite publicly known for my laboratory. I have no sources of funding from the cell phone industry. In fact, I'm quite annoyed at the amount of money that they seem to charge me every month. But
like the rest of us, yes.
Yes, that's a side note. What I tried to do is I tried to use studies where such sources of funding were at least somewhat moderately known. And I really leaned upon the National Cancer Institute to guide me in this. And if you look up the National Cancer Institute website, which I encourage you to do at www.nci.org, that is the National Cancer Institute, which is, as far as I know, one of the least biased institutes in the United States, does extremely important work. The message in the National Cancer Institute is, having looked at several studies, that there has not been any convincing link. And I tried to follow the studies that they had followed through and tried to, identify the sources of funding for the various studies and the various companies. But, and where they were possible, I tried to declare them.
But George raises a point that a lot of people raise, because obviously the economic stakes in this are huge. And we do have an outstanding example of not so recent history, of recent history rather, where, again, with enormous economic consequences, the tobacco industry tried to hush up all the studies that linked smoking to cancer.
Absolutely. And it's very important to remember that because, and again, it very clearly pointed out both in the book and in the article, the tobacco industry has had an epic role in suppressing the evidence. The one difference that I would mark out between tobacco and lung cancer and several other forms of cancer in comparison to cell phones and brain cancer is that despite the efforts of the tobacco industry, the human studies were highly convincing. So there was as the rates of smoking increased, the rates of lung cancer and other cancers increased coincidentally. Human studies that were more experimental, in other words, if you asked lung cancer patients if they had prior smoking and compared them to control patients, again, highly, highly suggestive. Animal experiments, including very famous rabbit experiments done in the 1930s and 1920s by several scientists, again, clearly showed that if you painted tar from tobacco onto animals, they would get cancer. And in fact, subsequently, much more detailed analysis on human tissues and various other tissues have clearly showed that tobacco is a carcinogen. Now, if you use that kind of standard, thus far, as I said, there are some definitive trials pending, but thus far, cell phones have not met even one of these standards, I would say.
George, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I wish you would check out that study from the School of Public Health of the University of California, because it came out after his book was published.
Before this article, though.
But then he needs to look at that study, because I don't...
I will look at the study, and I would encourage you to look at the National Cancer Institute website.
Okay. Thanks, George. Let's see if we go next to... this is Carl. Carl with us from Minneapolis.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I was diagnosed with a brainstem glioma in December, and I just returned from radiation treatment at Mass General Hospital.
Well, sorry to hear about the bad news, Carl.
Oh, that's fine. The issue of cell phones came up in my diagnosis. A friend of mine sent me information from an agency called the Environmental Working Group that showed radiation output from various cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
And my phone was really quite high, so I got a new cell phone, and that has lower radiation levels. And I'm wondering what Dr. Mukherjee thinks of requiring cell phone manufacturers to publish radiation levels on their phones, and what the current discussion is on requiring this kind of information.
I would very much encourage cell phone companies to publish the radiation exposure from the phone. Number one, it gives consumers appropriate choice. Number two, actually it allows scientists to do better experiments. It allows epidemiologists to do the kinds of experiments, more refined kinds of experiments that allow us to better understand this phenomenon. So I'm very much for it. I think I also point out that I'm very much for as best possible within the realms of privacy, allowing epidemiologists and researchers to have access to real-time phone data so that, one doesn't have to rely on memory to figure out whether some patients have used a lot of phone time or some patients have used very little phone time, because memory can be very biased and very selective.
Has the cell phone industry, the manufacturers of the phones, have they been transparent throughout this process?
Well, it's. I think one has to begin again. Given the example of tobacco, one has to begin with suspicion, and only work backwards to non-suspicion. I think that transparency would be, for any large industry, would be a little bit of a stretch. I don't think that there has been a lot of transparency in many industries regarding exposure. But that said, scientists have found methods to expose, for instance, mice and rats to very long doses of radiation simulating the kind of radiation that cell phones emit. And thus far, all those experiments have primarily been negative as well. There was one major experiment that was reported on cells as positive, but that experiment has now been charged that that experiment is fraudulent. So we don't know whether that experiment was really true or not.
Carl, we wish you the best of luck with your treatment.
Same here.
Thank you very much.
You the best of luck.
We're talking with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, assistant professor in medicine in medical oncology at Columbia University, a practicing physician. He wrote the article, Do Cell Phones Cause Brain Cancer?, that appeared in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Yesterday got the Pulitzer Prize for Emperor of All Maladies, a Biography of Cancer. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go next to, this is Julia. Julia with us from Medical Lake in Michigan.
I'm in Washington State, by the way.
Okay.
Hi. Dr. Mukherjee, what a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on earning the Pulitzer Prize. I loved your book. It was a very personal experience, and it resonated very deeply with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your work. My question today is about when you ask such a specific question about cell phones and brain cancer, and you come up and you do your detective work and you identify, no, it doesn't look like it's going to have quite an effect, and you understand these malignancies in the adult brain, can you take that information, what you understand about the physiology of brain tumor, and make it applicable to what we understand in brain tumors in children, and vice versa? Can we learn from kids and apply that to the treatment in adults?
Well, it's a very important question. Now, the human trials that I talked about, the trials in which we've looked at the incidence or use of cell phones, have really been on adults. So it's hard to extrapolate the human data into children. There are certainly various toxins. I won't talk about carcinogens in particular. There are certainly various toxins that we know of which are specifically toxic to certain stages of development and are not toxic later in development. There are absolutely many examples of this. Now, that said, the animal data and the cellular data, the data on cells, whether cells change genes, whether genes mutate, or whether animals develop cancer, those data actually have been tried on very young animals. In fact, there was an experiment that was done where animals were treated with a chemical to prime them to have brain tumors in utero, and then radiation similar to cell phones was applied, and there was no increase in cancer. So from those animal data, we can extrapolate a little bit into children. But really, the studies that I've talked about have not looked at cell phone usage in children. Now, obviously, part of the reason was that in the past, cell phones were not being used by children to a large extent. This is a relatively recent phenomenon, although I'm told, in fact, that children are, some people tell me, and again, the studies are pending, some people tell me children are now using less cell phones because they're texting so much. I don't know what the exact studies are going to show in terms of actual usage relative to the parts of the head that are being used. But the quick answer to the question is the retrospective studies and the human studies have all been really performed on adults. The studies on cellular material and the studies on animals to some extent have been done on fetal or very young animals, and certainly the cells are cells.
Julia, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John is among those who have emailed to correct that the NCI website is cancer.gov, not cancer.org.
Pardon me, absolutely right.
Of course,
yes, absolutely.
A lot of questions on this, just little time, though. Does the radiation danger from phones only occur when they are active with a call? Do they emit radiation when simply on? I carry my phone in my pocket all day. Am I irradiating my hip or groin simply by having the phone in my pocket?
Yes, to some extent, there is radiation that occurs during when the cell phone is on, even in the not so active position. And there are some data on this. You can you can log in to an informational website on cell phones, and there are several available, and they will tell you exactly to what extent what we know about this radiation exposure.
Dr. Mukherjee, again, congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize yesterday.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Siddhartha Mukherjee, Assistant Professor of Medicine in Medical Oncology at Columbia University. He wrote, "Do Cell Phones Cause Brain Cancer?" in the New York Times Magazine. And yesterday, as we mentioned, won the Pulitzer Prize for "An Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer." Coming up next, Peter Loewenheim joins us. He realized he really didn't know his neighbors and came up with an eccentric experiment. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.